a synopsis of 5 minutes from last night. If you take your handout and open to page one, you will see the first page is entitled Anatomy of a Fall. Last night I proposed that abuse began in heaven with a figure known in the Bible as variously as the King of Tyre in Ezekiel 28 and the King of Babylon in Isaiah 14. That this person whom we have come as Christians to call Satan actually created, invented abuse. And we all know that this being came to be who he was through pride, that pride is the origin of his fall. And so we probed that a little bit, and what I proposed was that pride is not just supremacy, not thinking of myself as more superior than other people, but it is also low self-esteem. That it is actually thinking on a continuum of being greater or lesser, richer or poorer, better or worse. I call those words. We have a lot of them. We call them comparatives in English grammar. Even thinking in those terms is pride. That pride is the misvalue of a person. And I challenged everybody here last night to go home and think about what made them valuable. What was their true value? I propose that it is because we are created in the image of God with the power to think and to do. That we are inherently, by creation, valuable to God and thus should be valuable to ourselves. From pride, he easily moved to the next step, which is what I call externalism. People in the early 1800s called it formalism. It's really the same thing. Externalism is thinking that the external is more important than the internal, that it's more important how I think, how I act, how I behave, how I look, how I appear, than it is who I am inside. And I use the illustration Jesus used of the cup that you wash on the outside, and inside you leave unclean. This began with this being who corrupted his wisdom for the sake of his beauty. He came to think his external looks, his splendor, his outward appearance was more important than how he thought inside. I proposed last night that we were created in a state of grace. That grace isn't something invented after sin. Grace is simply the way God is. That we were created in a state of grace. We did not earn the Garden of Eden. We did not earn the right to the Tree of Life. We did nothing to earn anything God gave us from creation. And what we did is walk out of a state of grace, and God has been trying to bring us back into a state of grace ever since. And that has to do with how we think about ourselves, other people, and God. Well, from externalism, the next natural step is supremacy. Wanting to be first. Wanting to be the best. It's not enough to be better. It's important to be best, greatest, richest, and so on. So supremacy is the next natural step. And from supremacy, we want control. This being, whom we call Satan, attempted to gain control over the heavenly intelligences. Later, over us. Now, what happens when a person attempts to gain control over things, people, he misrepresents the truth. It's impossible for a person who becomes abusive to be honest. Why? Because the minute they're honest, they lose their power. They have to be honest, first of all, with themselves. And if they're honest with themselves, one of the hallmarks of abusers are that they are out of control internally, but hyper-controlling externally. That is, they attempt to control everybody around them, but they're out of control in terms of their own self-control. From there, a person who becomes an abuser is grasped for power. Power becomes more important than character or morality. And from there, the next natural step is that of violence. Finally, this whole scheme can become institutionalized, and when it is, we go into what I call imaging. That we could call it modeling. It happens when a person comes to think that this is the way of life, this is the way things are, this is the reality I have been put in, and this is how I should operate and think and function. That's imaging. Then the cycle of abuse becomes complete. Now, what I suggested for the right-hand column, this also is part of this cycle. And what happens to a person who thinks of themselves in superior terms, they create in other people low self-esteem. So they create victims all around them of other people who feel less worthy than they. Those who move into the realm of externalism create artificiality. Those who want supremacy create oppression. Those who want control create dependency. Misrepresentation creates deception in the minds of the victim. And power creates submission to power. Violence creates full victimization. And when a person conforms to this, believing that it is the right and true way, they then become full victims. What happens then? They are at high risk for being the next abuser. Now, if you turn to page 2 is all about what the serpent did, or rather what Satan did to the serpent, to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And I'm not going to take the time to lead you through this. You can scan it for yourself. But basically, what he did was to misrepresent the character of God as an abuser. And in order to do that, he abused Eve. So he did all the things he claimed God was doing to Eve while he was misrepresenting God. And he did this very subtly. He didn't blatantly say, God is an abuser. I want you to know that. He knew he wouldn't have gotten away with that. She wouldn't have believed him. So what he did was infer that God was an abuser. So you have to read between the lines of what he says. I do want to touch on two things that are very, very important. Eve fell into the trap of externalism. She thought that fruit would be capable of changing her ability to be like God. It had supernatural power to her, magical power. She came to see that. And when she saw that, everything changed. Her whole external perceptions changed. She became aware of her nakedness. Now, she was created naked. She was clothed with the glory of God. But when she rejected that glory, which was really rejecting a loving God, she lost that glory. And she found out she was naked. The second thing I want you to note is that the serpent claimed that she would not die. And that opened up a whole different way of looking at reality. We're going to pursue that a little more later. But basically, he suggested that God lied. And abusers, remember, tend to misrepresent the truth. He suggested that God lied, that nothing would happen, nothing would change if she ate the fruit. And finally, he charged God with knowing good and evil. And I stated last night that the worst kinds of abuse, in terms of the damage that it does to people internally, in terms of their self-worth and their perception, is an abuser who is one day abusive and the next day so wonderfully kind, trying to make up for his bad day of abuse, that he confuses his victim. This is especially true of children who suffer abuse, because they find mommy or daddy so good one day and so bad the next, and then so good the next day, that they become confused and they think, well, I must have deserved the bad day. I must have been my fault, because abusers are very adept at creating in the minds of their victims the idea that they're guilty of causing the abuse. You made me do it. I wouldn't have lost my temper if you hadn't been so bad. Those are the kinds of lines that abusers tend to feed their victims. So what Satan did, again, is to misrepresent God as an abuser. That immediately created victims. Adam and Eve became victims of abuse. Not real abuse, but imagined abuse. But the effect is the same. If you turn to page 3, I didn't go through the entire next 3 pages. I'll let you do that on your own, because we don't have time. We have a lot of ground to cover. But when it says, the woman saw the tree was good for food and it was desirable for the eyes, that was beautiful to look at, that is addiction. and all addictions find their appeal in the belief that the external realities control my life. That's what victimization is. That's what abuse is all about. It is selling my inner locus of control to someone else or something else to let it dominate my life and take over. And that can be God. It can be religion. In fact, I noted last night that statistically, behavioral scientists tell us that the highest levels of abuse are found in conservative Christian homes. That is, the most of your abusers, the majority of your abusers, are conservatives. Now, if you broaden that throughout the world, the same thing is true in every other religion besides Christianity. The most abusive groups in our world, in terms of how they dominate and use authority, lie in your very conservative faction of major religions in the world. The more religious a person is, the more tendency there is to abuse. And you might wonder why that is. We discussed that a little bit last night. I think it foundationally resides in having swallowed Satan's lies about God and having come to believe that he is an abusive person to the point where we don't think of it as abuse, but simply holiness. And we fall right into line with that and get trapped. So religion can be addictive. It can control. It can be our external means of controlling us to the point where we lose our own personal ability to have self-control. So, a child, for example, who's raised in a very strict home might grow up and when he's gone from home suddenly turn into a wild hunman. And why does he do that? Because he was so controlled externally by his parents and by his society that when he got away, he had no ability, he had no internal locus of control and fell apart. He was controlled by then the next external environment he met, which is whatever he was attracted to. And you can see this over and over again. I have witnessed it in lives of young people my age when I was growing up. I've witnessed it in my students. So, the other thing I want to point out on this page is that as a result of believing Satan's lies about God, when God came, he came as he had every other night, and they saw him as a fearsome, abusive tyrant, and they ran from him in terror. The hallmark of abuse is fear. And fear can become so ingrained in a person, particularly if it is religious fear, that we no longer know we're afraid. I remember one time trying to share some good news with a pastor's wife and a pastor who we didn't see eye to eye about God and the kind of person he is. And so we were kind of wrestling with some theological ideas, and they asked me some questions that led me to say that what my views had done for me is to relieve me from my fears of God. And I remember this woman sitting on the edge of her sofa and saying, "I'm not afraid of God. I'm absolutely not afraid of him." And she was just shaking in terror. And that's the denial that long-term fear can give us. We may not even know we're afraid. I remember when I first gained the picture of God that I now have when I was 15. I didn't think I was afraid of him. I lived in terror of him, but I didn't think I was afraid of him. And it took me years to look back and realize how terrified I really was of him. So what happened in the garden? Adam and Eve came to see God through Satan's eyes as an abuser. So they heard his voice, his loving voice that they had heard the night before and run toward him. They now heard it as a terribly threatening voice. It had turned sinister, heartless, cruel, and they ran from him in terror. Just like an abused child. My grandfather was severely abused by his father. He told me that as a child, he and his older brother and his younger brother used to run under the house and hide whenever they saw the father coming home from work. He was so abusive. Adam and Eve ran and hid. And the problem is, how are you going to unmask their deception? They're in a state of paranoia. And the problem with that state of paranoia is that it has affected all of us. My proposal last night is that we are all both victims of abuse and abusers. Every time we mistreat another human being, we reveal ourselves to be abusers. Every time we submit to abuse, we reveal ourselves to be victims. And my goal, this session and the final session, is to show us how to get out of that cycle. It's really the cycle of sin. But I think it's time to call sin by its right name. Its right name is abuse. And if we realize both how valuable we are to God and what the kind of life He wants us to live, I think our whole attitude towards sin and salvation would change. We would find a freedom and a joy and a buoyancy we never had before. So I invite you to turn to page 6 now. Before we move to the solution, I need to take one last look at the problem. And it's the problem that we have invented. God created three major institutions by which we could know Him as He is. They were intended to reflect His character. Creation, nature, natural law of cause and effect. For every cause there is an effect, every effect has a cause. To reason intelligently, sanely, and rationally, we have to believe that. Abusers do not believe that. Typically, they do not see themselves as responsible for the effects. They don't even know there are effects to what they do. So they don't reason from cause to effect. But if we remember our Creator and the kind of the universe He's created, He created a universe that operates on natural law. If I jump off a cliff, I'm going to defy the law of gravity. I'm going to suffer terrible consequences. If I take up some bad habit, some drug that destroys my body, I'm going to suffer those bad consequences. If I beat my child is going to have a warped picture of God and a warped picture of reality. Those are consequences. More than that, there's the ultimate consequence that God warned Adam and Eve about when He said, "You will surely die. Sin leads to death." He didn't say, "If you eat of the fruit, I will kill you." That would not be a consequence. That would be an imposed penalty. He said, "You will die. You will surely die." Meaning it's inherent that if you eat the fruit of the tree, you will die. Now, Adam and Eve didn't die right away. And so that has led many people on this planet to assume that God didn't mean what He said, that it was just a threat, or maybe that God would kill them someday. The truth is that God waited to demonstrate the truth of those words, and He did it Himself when He did. That's the whole purpose of Jesus' death, was to demonstrate that God was right. He was telling the truth when He said, "You shall surely die." So it's by understanding nature and natural law that we come to understand the kind of life God wants us to live, and that also has to do with our understanding of the spiritual realm. The spiritual realm has as many laws of cause and effect as does the natural realm. The difference between the natural realm and the spiritual or moral realm is that the natural realm, God could mess with those natural laws and change them and do anything He wanted to with them. But in the spiritual and moral realm, He can't. There is only one way things can work. There is only one way to have harmony and freedom in the universe, and that is through trust and trustworthiness and through love. There's no other way. God can't change the process. And that's what Satan tried to do. He tried to suggest there's another way. There's another way we can do things. He introduced abuse as the other way. Now I give you a whole list here of the things that we find in creation. This, unfortunately, our whole planet is becoming more and more distant from understanding this. We have children today who don't even know where cow's milk comes from. They don't know where fruit in the market comes from. They don't have a sense of cause and effect relationships because they're so far removed from nature. Growing up in cities where everything comes in a bottle and you can get it instantly from the supermarket. They don't even understand that some things take time to produce, like a tree takes time to grow. You can't just instantly create one with fruit loaded on it. Babies take time to grow. There's all these kinds of things that we are losing sight of as human beings because of the lifestyle we live. And that's all part of Satan's design, and I want to tell you in a minute how that started. The next institution that God created was the family. as a model for how he wanted relationships to be handled. Originally, Adam and Eve were created as equals in the image of God. It took both of them to create the image of God. They were created side by side. The Hebrew is very clear that Adam was not superior to Eve or not over her. They were both equal, side by side. And as a result, they were to complement each other and to create a kind of nurturing environment in which to bring lovingly children into the home. And they were to parent as God parents us, thus modeling to their children, because parents are in the place of God to their children, are they not? That's how children see God, is how they see mom and dad. So all of this was as a kind of extension of the divine family. And God wanted to model how he treats his creatures through family. Regrettably, because of Adam and Eve believing Satan's lies about God, what happened to that first family? Well, the oldest son, who Eve thought would be the savior of the world, turned into the murderer, the first murderer. We'll be talking a little bit more about murder. The final institution that God invented was Sabbath. Now, Sabbath is not usually pictured this way, unfortunately. But if you really look carefully at Sabbath, it means freedom, equality, rest and enjoyment. You see, in the Sabbath commandment, everybody is supposed to rest equally with God. There's no slaves in God's family. There's no hierarchical structures in God's family. There's time for relationships. That's what Sabbath is all about. More than that, Sabbath memorializes creation. So every week we're to remember how valuable we are, how we were created in the image of God, and what that means. We're to remember all of the things above. This is even more helpful if you understand that in Mesopotamia developed the notion that human beings are created to be slaves of the gods. That was their only reason for being. Their sole reason for existence was to give food offerings to the gods, build them a house, clothe them, entertain them with prayers and songs, and make sure that they were happy by burning incense. That's how Mesopotamians saw their reason for being. The Israelites, of course, came into that culture, or came out of that culture, in a sense, of Mesopotamia. And in a Mesopotamian culture, not only were human beings slaves of the gods, but they were never to rest. Only gods got to rest, not human beings. Because slaves never rest. I don't know if you're aware of the institution of slavery. The closest thing we have in our world is the system of amas. Are you aware of that system? Where women work out in families around the world in many places. They get terribly abused. They are treated like slaves. In fact, we actually have a slavery system, an underground slavery system in America, where wealthy people buy women of other cultures who can't speak English very well and thus don't know their rights and actually treat them like slaves. Been on the news in recent months. So this is the kind of thing of slavery, and a slave never gets a day off, never gets to enjoy rest. That would put him on equality, you see, with his boss. That's why a boss has a slave, so the boss can rest. Well, the Sabbath is all about God and his creatures resting with him. Everybody gets to rest. And it's very explicit about who does. Nobody gets out of resting. This is not about you can't. It's about what you can. The alternative that I believe Satan got human beings to create on this planet are to the right-hand side. Economy, kingship, and this will surprise you, law. Let's move through these in order. We talked a little bit about economy last night. Originally, human beings were a society of hunters and gatherers. They were an interdependent society. Everybody was valuable because everybody needed everybody. And they would go out and collectively gather and hunt, much like the American Indians of the United States. They lived off the land. They were careful to live in harmony with nature. And then one day, a group of people went to the southern region of Mesopotamia, known as Sumer in history, called in the Bible Shinar, and built a city. And they began to develop agriculture. And they began to be aware that maybe there was more to life than just making sure they survived. Maybe they could get a little richer than their neighbors. And thus economy was born. The idea that a person could make an exchange of two sheep for one ass, and maybe the next generation would up the price and say, I want three sheep for one ass. We call that inflation. Thus was introduced the concept of an artificial reality. I mean, who says that three sheep equal one ass? It's all in our heads. There's no equal value there. Those are two very different types of animals. And you can try to quantify maybe the results of having them. How much does an ass labor? How much is that worth? Versus how much wool do you get off of a sheep? How much mutton does he provide? You can do those kinds of mathematical figurations. But in terms of real value, you can't say three sheep equals one ass. There's no such thing. From bartering and exchange, society moved to monetary values. That became even more artificial and contrived. People finally became aware that not only could you objectify sheep and donkeys and oxen and chariots and things like that, but you could objectify people. And an economic system very rapidly moved to the institution of slavery, where we could actually own, buy and sell and work people like we do animals. We thus devalue them. In fact, slavery is the most abusive system human beings have ever invented, when you think about it. To own another human being, to control them, ultimately, where they sleep, what they eat, how much labor they work, whether they can rest or not, all of that, for one human being to control another human being like that, is to totally destroy the image of God in that person. That is ultimate abuse. As a result, society became stratified. There became the few wealthy, free people on top, the middle people who were the day laborers and government officials and so on, and then at the bottom, the slaves. Out of economy was developed law. Now, this one's the hardest one. It never fails, usually, in a class when I bring this up. My students object to law. Now surely, that's not a human institution. God invented law, did he not? Maybe I should raise that as a question today. Did God invent law? What kind of law? See, we looked at through everything through eyes that have had centuries of laws. So, we think in our construct, what laws, how many laws did God give Adam and Eve? I'm going to go to the Bible. One, you shall not eat. Is that a law? We talked about that last night. Is that a command? A natural law, cause and effect. That's the kind of law God has, okay? And we talked about that last night, and I pointed out, you know, when your toddler is creeping toward the stove, the hot stove, and about to put his hand on it, do you suddenly turn into a legislator and bark out, I'm issuing you a commandment. Thou shalt not touch the stove, or thou wilt be burned. That isn't what crosses the parent's head. Usually the parent scoops up the child before he reaches the stove and says, Johnny, I've got to warn you. That stove is hot. You'll get burned if you touch it. You see, warnings fit with cause and effect relationships. Law fits with, if you don't obey me, I'm going to punish you. Now, what would happen if you picked up your toddler and said, okay, Johnny, you think that you want to touch the stove? Let me show you what happens. That's abuse. That is often how we see God. See, what we've done is switch labels here. We've said the problem with us is God. So we've got to deal with God to get Him to love us, to forgive us, to to save us. The problem isn't sin. That's exactly what Satan wanted us to believe. He wanted us to switch those labels so that we would work on God, trying to change Him, trying to manipulate Him by our prayers, by our offerings, by our obedience, by whatever it is we do. And over here, we ignore sin. Sin isn't the problem. So we abdicate ourselves from personal responsibility. The truth is sin, not God. Sin leads to death. The wages of sin is death, not God. And that's so foundational to understanding abuse. Because once we switch those labels and God is the one who kills us, the sin won't hurt us. We've done exactly what Satan wants us to do. Because then you notice we'll sin with impunity because we think we've got to really fix it with God. And the truth is, sin is the problem. It's what leads to death. I'm going to go to a couple of scriptures. Let's look at Romans 5:20 first. I know you probably don't have your Bible, so you might want to write this down. And I'm going to have to give you my own translation of this verse because I don't know of a version that gives the Greek, the nuance of the Greek accurately. Paul says, law, and he uses law without an article, which means he's not referring now to the Ten Commandments. He's referring to law in general. All law. The use of law. Law sneaked in. Did God get sneaky with the law? No. Law sneaked in. The verb connotes a clandestine intruder. Not something up front. I mean, God thundered the Ten Commandments from Sinai. There was nothing sneaky there. So this is not talking about the Ten Commandments. This is talking about the use of law. Law sneaked in with the result that sin multiplied. I said last night that legalism is abuse. I would like to suggest that all abuse is legalism and all legalism is abuse. They're synonymous. I teach my students that fornication is legalism. They look at me in shock. What? We thought we were escaping legalism by doing fornication. And what do you mean fornication is legalism? Well, it is. Now you're going to wonder how I get there. I'll come back to that. All sin is legalism in a sense. It falls into this legal trap. And let me explain a little more how it happened. When Paul said, law sneaked in, he was stating a historical fact. I used to think, before I studied the ancient Near East, that law was an attempt to control crime and make people moral and good. I found that otherwise. You know why laws were invented? Laws were invented so that property owners could protect their property. It was an economic function, pure and simple. Ancient laws were developed for economic and no other reason. Now, you may find a few criminal laws mixed in some of the laws that you find, but those laws really have an economic base. In fact, the earliest precursor of law are actually economic measures taken by a king. Why would I put law over here on this side? Because it does not fit with the other side at all. It does not fit with a cause and effect side. It fits with an economic side, a virtual reality side, where we assume that we can externally control people and make them good by commanding them to obey us. And so we create laws. But do laws have a permanent function? Did you hear the story about the woman up in Michigan who had her kids with her? They were quite small. And she was walking along the riverbank. And a canoe that was out there in the river doing the rapids overturned. And the men in the canoe were swearing at the top of their lungs. They were so mad that they overturned their canoe. That they were just swearing. And this woman was angry that her children had to listen to all those cuss words. So she took them to court. And they found on the statutes of Michigan a law 100 years old that forbade swearing in public. And they pulled it out of the archives and tried to indict these people. to their shock. Didn't know such a law existed. Do laws have a permanent function? No. We overturn them all the time. We take them off our statute books. We create new laws. Laws change like the wind. You know what the latest driving laws are? I hope somebody tells me soon before I break one of them, because I haven't had to take a test in years. I'm sure they've changed some. One of these days they'll catch me, probably. Law does not have a permanent function. God's law is eternal and can never be changed, which means it cannot be legal. One of the things I try very hard to teach my students is that legal and moral are not necessarily the same thing. Now, let's go back to this idea of externalism. What is law? What is its function? Let's look at Galatians 3:19. Paul, after saying that law sneaked in to increase trespass and then moves to grace as the answer to the problem of sin, not law. He says, why then the law? This is Galatians 3:19. It was added because of transgression. You see, here's the timeline. Human beings invented law for selfish reasons, to control property and to keep their economic wealth. Those kinds of laws increased the trespass. They increased sin. So God, in order to meet people where they were who were so familiar with laws, added laws because of transgression. But Paul goes on to point out that the law has no power to break that cycle of sin. Has no power to break the cycle of abuse. Why not? Because it's external control. There's another way to ask the question. Can love be commanded? See, if all God wants is rule keeping, we can do that, although none of us are perfect at it. People who focus on rules select a few that are easy for them to keep and then judge everybody that doesn't keep them. They miss about half of the rules that are out there, especially the ones they don't like. They're very selective. That's human nature. Laws don't make people loving. God is not interested in rule keeping. He's interested in making people loving and lovable. That's what he's after. We're going to talk about that in terms of the Ten Commandments, but I need to move on. Law is the bailing wire that holds relationships together when there is no love or trust. I didn't create that. I have to owe that to one of my colleagues that I teach with, Angel Hernandez. He was the one that said that to me, and I liked it so well I've been using it ever since. Law is the bailing wire that we tie around a relationship in order to hold it together because there's no love and trust in that relationship. So we command it. Don't murder anybody. If you loved someone, would you murder them? You wouldn't even think of it. That's why Paul later says that love is the fulfilling of the law. What law is all about, in terms of God's law, is love. It's all about love. But you can't create love by a command. Let's take this scenario. You're back in, you're about 20 years of age. I'm talking to you men now. Most of you come from this tradition. You've taken the one you love and want to marry out to eat. You have a candlelight dinner, soft music, and you're as romantic as you know how to be. But you're also very terrified. And you look at her eyes across the table and you say, honey, will you marry me? And she says, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I love you. And you say, what? You better love me. I command you to love me. She hesitates. Not sure. Now I'm even less sure than I was before. Well, if you don't love me, I'm going to kill you. Can you get love that way? You might get compliant. So let's try another scenario. You're sitting in your living room and there's a knock at the door. You go to the door and you find a man with a gun and he's pointing it to your head and he says, submit to me or I'll kill you. Would you submit? Whatever you want, sir. You might rob me? Go take everything out of the house to save my life. Do you love him? Not hard. Love cannot be commanded. It cannot be won by force or authority. Only by love is love awakened. That's the only way you can get it. So, when we invented law, which we did before God ever gave the Ten Commandments, the earliest law codes go back to about 2100 BC. That is the ones we know about. There may have been some earlier ones than that. But the earliest ones we're aware of are 2100 BC. Sinai is at the very earliest 1350. That's approximately 750 years later. So human beings invent law as a substitute for real relationships of love and trust. See, have you ever thought about eternity? You're traveling along one of the streets in New Jerusalem, and you come to an intersection. There's no stop sign. What are you going to do? How can nobody put a stop sign here? Here comes another person coming along, breezing along that intersection, and they're meeting you. What are you going to do? Oh, dear, who's supposed to go first up here? Nobody's ever told us what the rules are. May I give you the right-of-way? Now, I hope the saints don't stand on street corners arguing about who gets the right-of-way because we're so loving and so kind that we can never get our business done. I don't think it's going to be that way. But if we were totally unselfish and loving, we would never need a stoplight or a stop sign. And we certainly wouldn't have road rage. So the law actually has counteracted and defied the law of love. It's actually opposed to it. It's a counterfeit. And then we have to ask ourselves, well, why did God use it? Well, how do you speak to Italians? You use English? You use Italian, right? I had a German grandmother, and she talked about speaking German, and it wasn't sprechen die Deutsch. It meant rather strong language. And I think of that when I think of speaking someone's language. You see, if people are already steeped in law, and they've already misunderstood love for law, or law for love, that's how you have to speak to them if you want to get anywhere with them. We're going to look at the Ten Commandments, though, in a different way, and just shortly. The third institutions that human beings invented is kingship. God never intended that one human being have power and control over another, that they actually rule other people. That's our invention. We invented the idea that we could give away our power and our rights to one single person who could make decisions for us, tell us what to do, where to go, and what to think. God never intended it to be that way. You remember the Bible story? God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. He didn't call him to be a king. He called him to be the what of a nation, of a great nation? The father. He called him back to the family model. A few hundred years later, his descendants wanted a king. They went to Samuel and said, give us a king. And Samuel said, no way. You're not getting a king. They said, we have to have a king. We want to be like the nations around us. You remember what God warned them about having a king? He said, if you have a king, he will take over your wealth, your economic advantages. He will use you. He will use your sons. He will use your property. He will tax you. He will do this to you, and he will do that to you. And the last line is, and you will be his slave. God didn't want them to have a king. You know what happens when we have kings? It's what happened in Mesopotamia first, and Israel mimicked it totally. God becomes like our earthly king. It's the ultimate creation of a systematized, institutionalized abuse because God becomes king. He thus becomes to look like every human potentate who is so commanding and authoritarian. I have a cartoon in my files. It shows a medieval king walking back and forth in front of his huge picture glass window while outside his subjects are in revolt. They have their pitchforks and their spears, and they're just yelling and screaming, and they're obviously ready to kill him. And he says to his wife, who is the queen, if only I could force them to love me. That's kingship. In fact, what happened with kingship, with the rise of kingship, human beings came to understand the big person on top, whether it was the gods or whether it was a human being, could get angry at any moment and decide to punish you. And as a result, they invented appeasement. That led ultimately to child sacrifice, which was rampant in the Canaanite religion. There's a lot more I could go into, but basically what happened is that we took these models and we applied them to God. And we said, God is like an economist, God is like a king, and God is like a lawgiver. We have come to institutionalize this whole system to portray God that way. So what is the antidote? The Ten Commandments. Now, this is not the only antidote. We're going to look at the Ten Commandments, since we've talked so much about law. Only, you'll be surprised if you looked at page 7. I don't have 10 commandments there. I have 14. You might wonder where I came up with 14 commandments. Well, we've been wrong all our lives calling them the Ten Commandments. That's the problem. I'm not trying to change you on that. I still refer to them as the Ten Commandments. In the Hebrew, they are not Ten Commandments. In fact, in the Bible nowhere calls them the Ten Commandments. It calls them the Ten Words. The word word in Hebrew can mean article, like articles in the Constitution. And what we have are 10 articles, but 14 commandments. What I did is I went through my Hebrew Bible and I counted all the imperatives. Imperatives are simply a grammatical term for commands. I counted them all and came up with 14. 7 that have to do with our relationship with God and 7 that have to do with our relationship for man. I have occasionally sleepless nights. And I remember one of those sleepless nights lying awake and thinking, if there's 14 commandments, 7 in our relationship to God and 7 in our relationship to human beings, there must be some parallels. So I started thinking about those parallels between our relationship with God and our relationship with other people. And lo, as I lay awake, they all paralleled very neatly. I got very excited. So you have those parallels right here. You shall have no other gods against my face. Value your father and your mother. What do those two have in common? Well, I give you a key on the far right-hand column. Parents are the earliest representatives of God to the children. If you don't value your parents, providing they represent God at least halfway. None of us are perfect. There's not a perfect parent in the world. So if you're worried about that, that isn't what this is about. But reasonably loving. If you fail to honor your parents who have been reasonably loving and kind and good, how can you have a right picture of God? How can you not have other gods before God? They're very tied together. But you have to think apart from commandments and think in terms of human development. How we process things. How we think about things. You shall not murder is related to you shall not make for yourselves an idol or any image of what is in the heavens above or in the earth below or in the waters beneath the earth. What does that have to do with murder? It has a lot to do with it. If you look in Genesis 9:6, I won't turn to it because our time is running out. If you look at Genesis 9:6, you find that the reason given for why murder is a capital crime is because we were created in the image of God. Now, it gets deeper than that. What does it take for a person to murder another human being? You know that there is a chemical control in everybody's brains that keeps them from killing one of their own kind. In fact, it's in true of the animal world as well. There's only a few exceptions in the species that will actually kill their own kind, such as black widow spiders. But most animals will not kill their own kind. It's because there's a chemical that's released that inhibits their ability to kill their own kind. What does it take then to break that down, to bypass that chemical release so that a person can actually kill another person? The image of God must be destroyed in them. Before a person can murder, he must first have been murdered, either by himself or by his environment or by his family. That explains our whole society. Thus, anything, to push this a little deeper, anything that destroys the image of God in another human being is a form of murder. So if we change the image of God in our perceptions, if we make an image of God that is inferior to Him, it does not match who He is. You know, the Egyptians worshipped beetles, the crocodile, the Nile, flies, every conceivable thing. Can you imagine going home tonight and kneeling down and praying to a scarab of a beetle and saying, "Dear Lord Beetle, please bless my family"? What would it take for you to do that? That would be, it has to be the destruction of the image of God within your mind. And Romans 1 talks about that extensively. How human beings, by changing the image of God into that of an ox or some other creature, actually lost their capacity to reason. Their senseless minds became darkened, and they became futile in their thinking. That's what it takes to create murder. You shall not bow down to them. You shall not commit adultery. What does that have to do with it? Well, do I dare get explicit? Bowing down to a god is not much different than having sex illegitimately. In fact, the two often go together. Bowing down to another god is submitting yourself to an inferior person who does not love you. That's what adultery is. In its broadest sense, adultery outside of marriage is submitting to a person who probably doesn't really love you. Now, I know it's always claimed that that's not true, but I would like to propose to you that, and this will give me, I'll have to give you the key now to fornication and legalism. Wrong forms of sexual activity that the Bible condemns, adultery, fornication, are actually an attempt to get to the fruit of a relationship without the relationship. It is enjoying the sexual activity without a lifetime committed relationship of love and trust that's been established. That is fornication, that is adultery, and that is legalism. So bowing down to a god, a false god, is demeaning my own value because I'm serving something that doesn't love me. And I'm committing myself without a relationship of love and trust because there is no way in the wide world that I can develop a relationship of love and trust with a false god. So to bow to a false god is basically saying, okay, I surrender, don't kill me. All the false gods that Israel bowed to and prostrated themselves before were horrible, vengeful, tyrannical, abusive gods. There wasn't one of them that wasn't. All false worship leads us to become victims because we become controlled by something or someone that does not value us, that did not create us, and that does not want us, and does not love us. You shall not serve them and you shall not steal. What in the world does that have to do with the fetish? Well, what does it mean to serve a false god? That's an economic term, isn't it? It has to do with slavery. You see, all false worship creates slaves. And slaves is an economic property kind of issue. So you shall not steal, which is an economic problem, is this stooping to this belief that things are more important than people, and people can be made to be things. That's stealing in its broadest sense. And a person who steals, now I know that in medieval times people stole all the time because they were very hungry. Well, society had stolen from them, basically. They were simply acting out what society had taught them in order to survive. But in our modern society, most thieves are stealing for other reasons. They are stealing because they no longer respect the boundaries of a person. And they see themselves as slaves and us as slaves, and it doesn't matter. We don't own anything anyway. It's a total diminishing of human value that leads to theft. Finally, you shall not devalue Yahweh's name. Now, you may wonder why I put Yahweh's name here. the Hebrew word is Yahweh, it's not Lord. You know, we tend to think of this only in one-way street, in terms of external approach, such as swearing. There's a problem with that. The verse goes far beyond that. It includes that, but it goes far beyond it. What this means is not to misrepresent and to lower the value to other people of who God is. I don't know if you remember Exodus 33 and 34 when God passed before Moses and proclaimed his name, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, by no means forgive the guilty. I can't remember. Anyway, you know the text. That whole spiel is Yahweh's name. It doesn't end with Yahweh, Yahweh. It's Yahweh, Yahweh, a God, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth. Why is that? Because name in the Bible means character. So I could have said here, you shall not devalue Yahweh's character. That is, you shall not misrepresent Him. And that is very closely tied to you shall not make a false testimony against your neighbor. You see, if we misrepresent God, we are going to misrepresent other people and falsely accuse them, falsely testify against them, tell tales about them to other people. Now, I've already talked about the Sabbath. I want to talk about what we commonly call the Tenth Commandment. The Tenth Commandment says it's not enough to externally keep these commandments. You shouldn't even want to. So it's not enough not to refrain from killing your neighbor. You shouldn't even want to or think about it. It's not enough to refrain from committing adultery. You shouldn't even want to. You see where that suggests the commandments really go to? They go to relationships. They go to our attitudes, most of all. In order to keep the tenth commandment, and thus all of the above, one has to have love in their heart. There is no way around it. Turn to page 8. I now would like to talk about these now ten commandments. In fact, the first four commandments, as we traditionally see them, as descriptive law. And we may not get through this before our time is up, but we'll see what we can do. Now we come to the heart of how to get off the cycle of abuse. The rest of it was kind of probably a little less good news. But this is the good news part. How do I keep the first commandment? And what does it really mean? How do I not know that when God said, you shall have no other gods before me, He wasn't acting rather high and mighty and proud and arrogant and abusive? Now, I know that sounds very daring to even suggest, but we know He's not like that. How do we know? See, I think Satan has gotten us to look at that commandment as a commandment of tyranny. God is the big person on top, and He lords it over us, and He tells us what to do. Let me tell you how that's really come to us in our Bibles. I mentioned the use of Yahweh. You should not devalue Yahweh's name. Post-exilic Jews got very nervous about that commandment and decided that in order to keep from ever, ever coming close to breaking it, they would substitute something for Yahweh. And so whenever they came to Yahweh in their Hebrew Bibles, they would read Adonai or Yadonai, which Orthodox Jews do to this day. As a result, the Septuagint translators, the translators of the Greek Old Testament, which lived well before Christ, substituted the Greek word kurios wherever they found Yahweh. The Latin Vulgate translated it with, I don't remember the Latin term for Lord, but they translated something similar. And as a result, we today in our Bibles do not have the name Yahweh in it. Now, I'm not ascribing to the denomination that believes we should put it back in. But I want to explain to you that we have made a terrific transfer, a complete transfer of the kingship model onto God with that substitution. Because every time we read our Bibles, we reinforce in our minds that God is Lord, and He rules like any sovereign Lord. I want to show you the Bible doesn't teach that. First of all, as we noted, Yahweh is not tied to lordship. It is tied to character. God, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth. Keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, who will by no means clear the guilty, and so on. Look at Hosea. There's a powerful little passage. You see, what happened is they fall in the same trap as the Canaanites and the Mesopotamians, who came to call their supreme deities by the term Lord. One of those titles was Baal. Baal, we think of Baal as a deity. He really is a title. There were many Baals. As Hosea recognizes, Hosea uses the plural form of Baal when it talks about Baal. There were many Baals, all of them demanding human sacrifice, practically. They were lords who lorded over people. And here's what Hosea's response is to that. He talks about how he's going to discipline the Israelites. He's going to let them go back to slavery, but he's going to win them back to himself, like a husband wins a spouse. Hosea 2, verse 16 is where I'm focusing. On that day, says Yahweh, you will call me my husband. The term in Hebrew is a term for equality. It is my ish. And ish and isha are husband and wife in Hebrew. Equality. There's nothing in the terms to denote a hierarchy. So he says, on that day, you will call me my husband in terms of equality, and no longer will you call me my Baal. Now, why would he say that? He's doing a pun on Baal worship. He's saying, you think of me as a sovereign Lord who dictates to you everything and lords it over you and demands your children as human sacrifices to appease me. I am not going to let you do that anymore. I am not your Baal, capital B. It also has a different meaning. The term Baal was used in ancient laws to denote owner of property and husband of a wife. It was the legal term for husband. That's how far down the trajectory of a hierarchical system, of abusive system, society had gone. God says, I am going to take the names of the Baals from your mouth, and they will be mentioned by name no more. I will make for you a covenant that day with the wild animals, the birds of the air, and so on. I will abolish the bow, the sword, and the war from the land. I will make you down, lie down in safety, and I will take you for my wife forever. I will take you for my wife in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and mercy. I will take you for my wife in faithfulness, and you will know Yahweh. It's a totally different way of looking at it. God is saying, I hate being called Lord. Well, they didn't get the message, and so Jesus had to deal with it in Mark 10. You remember his disciples were always arguing about who would be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And this is what Jesus said. This is Mark 10:42. You know that among the Gentiles, those who they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not to be so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. God is not a dictator, not a tyrant, not a lord, not a sovereign, in the sense that we have developed that notion on earth. Now, the Bible does refer to God as a sovereign, but think what kind of a sovereign he is. When Jesus came on this planet, he came to reveal how he runs his universe. How did he run it? Totally with love and truth and freedom. That's the kind of sovereign he is. It's not like any sovereign we know on our planet. So, when he says, you shall have no other gods before me, what is he saying? Why would he say such a command like that? It's very simple. If we have any other gods before God, we have cheated ourselves out of being loved by the Supreme Lover. I said something last evening in response to a question at the end that I'm going to state again. When I was a child, I struggled over the concept of love. What is love? In our family, the thing to do before we went to bed was to say, I love you, Mommy and Daddy. And some nights, I just didn't feel like I loved anybody. And I didn't know whether I was lying when I said, I love you, Mommy and Daddy. And I remember stewing in my mind, am I lying? Maybe I shouldn't tell them I love them, but if I tell them I don't love them, I'm going to make them feel bad, and I don't want to make them feel bad, so maybe I love them. I remember wrestling with that. I was 8 years old. And I never stopped wrestling with love. What is love? Love isn't rational. Is it? I mentioned, you know, would you let your son have a Ferrari and let him crash it and then give him, turn around and give him another one? Let him crash that one and then turn around and give him another one? But isn't that what God has done with us? You know, he gave us this planet to protect the animals, to take care of everything. Look what we've done with it. What did he do? Turn around and give us his son. And look what we did to him. And you think he wants to entrust us with eternal life? What kind of a God is this? Is this rational? No, love isn't rational. Not in the sense we think of rational. Our view of rational is kind of warped. So what is this thing about love? And I struggled and wrestled with it for years and years until I was teaching. Only a few years ago, I had a student in my class who wrote a reaction to a book in which she said, love cannot be taught, explained, or even described. It can only be experienced. Love, by its very nature, is experienced. And to show you how true that is, you know what happens to an infant who does not receive love? It dies. That's what behavioral scientists tell us. An infant who is not loved, they may be fed, diapered, clothed, so on, physically kept alive, but they will die without love, without being held, without being cuddled. That's why infants that are put in prenatal units, because they arrive too soon, are at such high risk. That's why they allow parents to go in and to touch them as soon as possible, to try to convey to them a message of love. And children who have been detached at birth too long from their parents suffer detachment disorders when they grow older. That means that the law of life is the law of love. It means that we are only capable of loving another person to the extent that we have had been recipients and have experienced genuine love. Now, there's good news in that. And at 7 this evening, I will be sharing that good news with you. We can start over our lives. We can be born again. We can be reparented and learn to love and experience love. But that's what it takes when we've been robbed of it in the first round. So when it says, you shall not have other gods before my face, no other gods before me, God is not being selfish, tyrannical, oppressive, dictatorial, and arbitrary. He is simply stating a truth. That without my being first and supreme in your life, you are severing yourself from the source of love. You will no longer have the capacity to love or to be loved. It's like the river's drying up and you no longer have any water. You're going to die of dehydration. So there's a restatement of this first commandment, I believe, in 1 John 4:19, and it's a descriptive law. We love because he first loved us. How did he first love us? Hopefully through our parents. How does he want to love us again? Through a new birth experience, a reparenting, which we'll talk about later this evening. The second commandment is the other principle on which our whole escape from abuse depends. You shall not make yourselves an idol or image of anything is really restated with, by beholding, we become changed. Why is it wrong to make an image of God? Because it devalues his character to us. It lowers who he is. He becomes less loving. How do we paint Christ? A lot of people are out there painting Christ these days. I look at all their pictures and I think they sure haven't met him. Their Christ looks so cold, so stiff. There's a few exceptions to that I like. But so many times the pictures of Jesus that we have are nothing like I believe you really were. So by beholding, we become changed, and whatever we focus on becomes an image that takes the place of God. Whatever we focus on that draws us away from God, that becomes a substitute for Him, is an image. And we will become like that which we focus on. It is a law. We can't break it. Just as it's a law that we can only love if we've been loved, it is also a law that by beholding we are changed. That what we focus on, spend our time with, we become like. And finally, it follows that it's crucial that we not misrepresent God to other people. But the flip side of that is, if we follow the light, we follow God. If we follow God as He really is, we know that God is light and no darkness exists in Him. We won't misrepresent Him. That's why Jesus could say, "You are the light of the world. Let your light shine." You know that this thing on witnessing that some of us have made a big deal about is nonsense. You don't go out and witness. You are a witness. You either witness to a good God or a bad God. Everything you do witnesses to God. So the thing of going out and witnessing isn't something you put on for maybe one day a week. It's something you are. You are a witness. The truth is that if we see the light and we believe the light, we will witness to it. What I want to leave you with is encapsulation, because this is heavy stuff and you could kind of go away in a daze and wonder what you even learned. But I want to encapsulate it. That the fundamental way to get out of the cycle of abuse is, first of all, to meet the supreme non-abuser, God, and to experience His love. We're going to talk about how to this evening. The second is to get to know Him and to behold Him until we become like Him. Because you can't even recognize that we're being abused half the time if we haven't found out what it's like to not be abused. I was in an experience one time where I was abused and didn't know it. I thought I was just being very righteous and holy in the way I was responding to the abuse. I moved away from there and got in a new situation that was parallel to the old situation, but with different people involved. And I was treated so differently that I suddenly realized, you know, I was abused. That was terrible what they did to me. You can't recognize what abuse is until you've experienced what true love is. Otherwise, we all get sucked into it on some level, in some way, with some person. Maybe even with ourselves, our own self-abuse. So, I would like to say that the two principles is that we love because He first loved us. And by beholding, we become changed. I'll leave you with that, and we'll see you back at 7 o'clock. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Dear God, I pray that we may come to see You not as Satan has made You out to be, but as You really are, a non-abusive, non-threatening, non-coercive, non-arbitrary God, a parent who loves us and who can show us what true love is. May we not rest short of learning the full truth about You as revealed in Jesus. We pray these things in His name. Amen.